We're going to move on now and talk about colorectal cancer here. Really thrilled to have Dr. Chris Liu from the University of Colorado in Aurora, Colorado, and Dr. John Strickler from Duke University. And we're going to talk about IOs in the management of colorectal cancer, fascinating developments in terms of MSI-high disease, but also now we're starting to see MS-stable disease, and Chris is going to review that for us. Chris?
Great. Thank you for the kind invitation, and welcome, everybody. You know, I just gave an early-stage colon cancer talk to all my fellows and told them, listen, if you don't know the answer, just say FOLFOX. And if FOLFOX is the wrong answer and your attending shakes their head, just say KPOX and just see if that works. And I'm happy to say, you know, John Marshall likes to say we haven't had an improvement, right, in adjuvant colon cancer for 25 plus years. And I'm hoping to change your minds, right, over the next 10 minutes to talk about neoadjuvant and adjuvant immune checkpoint inhibitors for MSI-high and deficient mismatch repair colon and rectal cancers. I'm really asking the question, should immunotherapy go first or after surgery? And I'm sure we'll be talking about that later. Also want to discuss immunotherapy in a frontline setting for MSI-high colon cancers. Is doublet better than single agent? And want to talk about some emerging data on immunotherapy for mismatch repair proficient or MSS metastatic colon cancer. So what is the data for immune checkpoint inhibitors with patients with non-metastatic rectal cancer that are MSI-high? And so this is the dostarlimab trial that's been presented several times now, and this is a really straightforward study. Patients with advanced rectal cancer were to receive dostarlimab at 500 milligrams every 3 weeks for 6 months. And then after radiographic and endoscopic evaluation, if they had a complete clinical response, they could go on to non-operative management. And if they had residual disease, they could go on to standard of care total neoadjuvant therapy. And of course, this is the slide and the data that led to about 200 calls to our offices asking about dostarlimab after this was presented, not only at ASCO, but also printed in the New York Times. And that was 100% clinical complete response rate in the 42 patients that had completed dostarlimab. And this is updated this year and presented and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. What you see on the left are all the complete responses, 100%, right, for rectal cancer. And then what you're seeing on the right is actually not only rectal cancer, but a lot of other diseases as well. Colorectal cancer in green is upper GI cancers, in orange urothelial cancers, and others. And you can see that there's a really, really high rate of complete clinical response, not only in rectal cancer, but in other cancers as well. There are a handful of recurrences, though, but none seen in rectal cancer. And so the take-home point here, and what you're seeing on the right is the latest update from NCCN, is that I do believe that neoadjuvant immune checkpoint inhibition appears ready for prime time for rectal MSI-high adenocarcinomas. And you can see here with the arrow that it's actually the preferred regimen to start with an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And you can imagine the difference of having a complete clinical response and not undergoing an APR. That's a tremendous advance for these patients with MSI-high rectal cancers. So there's some questions that remain, though. Should we be doing immunotherapy for stage one rectal cancers? What if the patient requires an APR for a stage one rectal cancer? It's something to certainly consider. Should we be using combination therapy? You're going to see some combination therapy data in colon cancer. Do we know for sure that pathologic complete response or clinical complete response means a cure? And we are going to need to have long-term survival data to truly know if this is a surrogate endpoint for cure. And what is the impact of immunotherapy on proficient mismatch repair or microsatellite stable colon cancer? That data is emerging, and there appears to be some amount of response rate when you give immunotherapy even to MSS rectal cancer, but that's obviously an emerging field. The AZUR-1 study is dostarlimab in MSI-high locally advanced rectal cancer. Again, a similar design to what you've seen before. Patients with locally advanced rectal cancer are going to get dostarlimab for 6 months and then tumor assessment with the option to go on to standard of care therapy if there's residual disease. Well, what about colon cancer? So when we look at MSI-high colon cancer, this is a study that was done in Europe, the NICHE-2 study, looking at doublet immunotherapy preoperatively for, again, MSI-high colon cancers. And what's interesting about this is that this is not a ton of neoadjuvant immunotherapy. They got 2 cycles of nivolumab and just 1 dose of ipilimumab prior to surgery. And of course, here, 95% major pathologic response, 67% complete response pathologically. This was just presented at ESMO 1 year ago, showing 100% three-year disease-free survival, data that I never thought I would see really almost in any cancer, but certainly in colon cancer. That's a pretty astounding result. And of course, at ASCO, the ATOMIC study was presented asking a bit of a different question. In patients that have had resected stage 3 colon cancer that are MSI-high deficient mismatch repair, they are randomized to receive standard of care chemotherapy, which is FOLFOX, or FOLFOX for 6 months, followed by atezolizumab for an additional 6 months, totaling a year of immunotherapy. And this was a plenary session at ASCO showing that the disease-free survival in the FOLFOX atezolizumab arm was 86% versus 76% for the standard of care arm, showing that in patients with resected MSI-high colon cancer, if they receive no neoadjuvant upfront, we should be offering them combination chemotherapy and atezolizumab. So the take-home points is this question of neoadjuvant therapy for MSI-high colon cancer. And this is where it gets a little bit tough. You're looking at the NCCN guidelines showing that if it's clinical T4B or bulky nodal disease, the preferred regimen is actually a checkpoint inhibitor. Now, the problem with this is that sometimes it's hard to radiographically appropriately stage these patients. So we're not entirely sure, right, when we look at a CT scan, that we know exactly what the stage is. And so there are two things. There's always a chance that you're actually over-treating a patient because what if they have stage 2 colon cancer that's MSI high? We don't offer those patients adjuvant therapy because their recurrence risk is so low. But here, if you have a pretty good sense that the tumor is large or there's bulky nodal disease, I think it does make sense to start with neoadjuvant immunotherapy, and I'm sure we're going to discuss this more. The question to the group is simply this. If you had high-risk stage 3 disease, would you want a couple of doses of immunotherapy prior to surgery, or would you want 6 months of FOLFOX followed by 1 year total of atezolizumab? And this is the calculating thing that our patients are going to really have to decide with their providers. Many patients receive their resection up front, and then they show up to the medical oncology office with MSI-high stage 3 colon cancer. Well, we do have an answer for those patients now. We should be offering them FOLFOX and atezolizumab, but the questions are, do they all need 6 months of FOLFOX? We don't know. Could they get away with just doing immunotherapy? We don't know the answer to that either. But right now, the answer is FOLFOX atezo. So, a couple of questions. Should we consider non-operative management for MSI-high colon cancer? And then the question again to the group is, well, would you rather have a hemicolectomy or would you rather undergo a colonoscopy every 3 months? That prep is something that's not trivial. What's the best duration of immunotherapy prior to resection? We don't know the answer to that. In the NICHE study, it was 2 doses of nivolumab and 1 dose of ipilimumab. Should it be 6 months like it is in rectal cancer? Should it just be a couple of doses? Keep in mind that in the NICHE study, 115 patients were treated under that regimen. Only 3 of them ever got adjuvant chemotherapy. And is there a role for immunotherapy in proficient mismatch repair colon cancer? There are a couple of trials ongoing. This is an MSI-high colon cancer. This is the AZURE-2 study. Patients are randomized to receive dostarlimab, surgery, dostarlimab, or placebo, surgery, and then chemotherapy. And you can already see what the problem with the study design is that after June of this year, this control arm is no longer considered to be the standard of care. There are several studies trying to look at neoadjuvant immunotherapy in MSS, or proficient mismatch repair colon cancer. So this is the AZURE-4 study. Patients are randomized to receive CAPOX in combination with dostarlimab or CAPOX alone, followed by surgery. And it's kind of an interesting primary endpoint here is major pathologic response, defined by having less than or equal to 10% residual viable tumor. So again, you're going to see more and more studies really trying to investigate this idea of immunotherapy in proficient mismatch repair colon cancer. Well, what about immunotherapy in the frontline treatment of metastatic colon cancer? So here, there are 2 large phase 3 randomized clinical controlled trials looking at immunotherapy versus chemotherapy, and I hope these curves really convince you that this question has definitely been answered. Patients with newly diagnosed metastatic colorectal cancer that are MSI-high or deficient in mismatch repair should start, if they're eligible, with immunotherapy. And the reason why is because these progression-free survival curves are just so significantly different. In fact, there are 2 take-home messages. Number 1, immunotherapy should go first. Number 2, when you look at the response rates and the progression-free survival, it looks like this is a chemotherapy-resistant population up front, thus telling you that immunotherapy really should go first. Well, is it doublet immunotherapy or single-agent immunotherapy? The CheckMate 8HW study was a metastatic colorectal cancer study in the frontline setting, randomized to Nivo versus Nivo-Ipi versus chemotherapy. Well, we know the answer, right, of Nivo-Ipi versus chemotherapy and pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy. But what about Nivo-Ipi versus Nivo? And this was presented now a couple of times. These are progression-free survival curves. And when you look at the 24-month progression-free survival, it's 71% in favor of nivolumab and ipilimumab doublet immunotherapy versus 55%, which is the nivolumab alone arm. Now, these are four doses of ipilimumab, so your patients will have more toxicity associated with that. And so what I'm showing you is the treatment-related adverse event rate on the left for doublet immunotherapy and for single immunotherapy. So you can see that while this is still a fairly well-tolerated regimen, there is a higher adverse event rate. So my take-home point here is that patients with metastatic colorectal cancer that are MSI high should receive immunotherapy in the frontline setting. And I will tell you that this data is really compelling. When you look at those progression-free survival curves and you see the tails of the curves actually being much higher with the nivolumab and ipilimumab, I think our patients with MSI-high metastatic colorectal cancer are really asking for the opportunity to potentially cure their disease. And if we have that opportunity, we should take advantage of it. So I would say in eligible patients, providers should strongly consider dual immunotherapy with nivolumab and ipilimumab. So I'm going to wrap up with the question that many of us in the room are just really, really wanting to answer, and that is, with the success of immunotherapy in so many disease types, this is one area that has failed repeatedly in microsatellite stable colorectal cancer in a metastatic setting. So all this exciting data with MSI-high colorectal cancer, but of course, depending on the stage, you're looking at somewhere between 4 and 15% of your patient population. But particularly in metastatic setting, we know that this is just 4% of our patient population. And so there's this really interesting data that is emerging. And this was an article that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology just a couple of months ago that I think is a really interesting finding and is a really good take-home message for the accumulation of data of immunotherapy in this setting. And what you're looking at here with the blue bars are response rates in patients that have non-liver metastatic disease. And what you see in the gray bars are those patients with liver metastatic disease. And what you see across retrospective studies, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 studies, is that there is a decent response rate with immunotherapy in patients that do not have liver metastases. When you look at the patients that do have liver metastases, the response rates are definitely in the single digits. In some cases, the response rates are completely zero. But it does beg this question of, well, if immunotherapy doesn't work in non-liver metastatic disease, is there some evidence to suggest that it does work in non-liver metastatic disease? And so this is the LEAP-017 study looking at lenvatinib and pembrolizumab versus standard of care. And the standard of care arm here is either TAS-102 or regorafenib. What you're looking at here is a completely negative study. But when you divide out the liver metastatic disease and the non-liver metastatic disease, a really interesting finding starts to emerge in that you start to see trends in terms of improved overall survival, improved progression-free survival, and an improvement in response rate. And so when you look at another immunotherapy study, so this is a combination botensilimab-balstilimab study in non-liver metastatic disease, you see the phase 1 trial with these waterfall plots showing a pretty significant response rate in patients that don't have liver metastases. When you look at the randomized phase 2 at two different doses of botensilimab, you see roughly about a 19% overall response rate. And it's not just the response rate really that you're looking at here. When you look at some of these survival curves, you can see that the responses, particularly when they're deep responses, there is a percentage of patients that have a durable response to these drugs. And so certainly an evolving story in metastatic colorectal cancer. And so that brings me to this, and this is a study that will be presented literally in the next couple of days. The STELLAR-303 study is a refractory study in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer that have progressed on FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, and they're randomized to receive either regorafenib or zanzalintinib and atezolizumab, and you can see that you can see in the bottom right-hand corner the targets for Zanza. And this study had a primary endpoint of overall survival. And there was a press release a couple of months ago saying that it did meet its overall survival endpoint with the zanzalintinib and the atezolizumab combination. And so the two questions that we're really going to be looking at when we see the results of this study, because I do believe that if there's an overall survival benefit, it's likely to change standard of care. So I want everybody in the room to be aware of the study. But of course, we're going to ask two questions, right? Number one, what is the impact or the total impact on the overall survival? Is it large or is it small? And then the second question, was all the benefits seen in non-liver metastatic disease, or were there responses in patients that had liver metastatic disease? And those are two things that we don't know the answer to, but hopefully we'll find out in the next couple of days. So the take-home point there is just to stay tuned. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks so much, Chris. Wow, I wrote four pages of notes here.
Yeah.
I don't know where to get started. Let's start at the end because it's still in my mind. So Zanza, how is it tolerated compared to regorafenib? That's, you know, and how do you think it's going to play out combining with an IO?
Yeah, I mean, there's similar toxicities. I think those that have experience with it will tell you that that the toxicity profile is probably a little bit better, but still, I mean, it's a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, so you're still going to deal with the same adverse events that maybe we see a little bit with even fruquintinib, which is another FDA-approved a drug. But, I think here the question is going to be also what does the, you know, combination toxicity look like? And so we'll see that in the phase 3 as well.
John, any thoughts about that? And also this issue of liver mets, any explanation for why you see a difference? Is it biologically or not at the time? What's going on there?
So, you know, this STELLAR 303 study, I've not seen any of the data. I was not involved in the trial itself. I find the trial design to be a little bit interesting in that when we know it's a positive trial, but there's one question around, well, does it matter if you have liver mets or not? The other question is, is zanzalintinib by itself superior to regorafenib? So how much is the atezo really adding to this? That's what I'm going to be looking out for when we see these results presented, is the magnitude of benefit and whether we think it's an immunologic mechanism or just a superior TKI. So, that's where I am today. We'll see where I am next week when after the data is presented.
Chris, what about this issue of liver mets versus non-liver mets? What do you think the explanation is?
Yeah, so the liver actually acts as a school, interestingly, for T cells. And that school can sometimes be beneficial, and it can sometimes be detrimental. And so when you think about, like, you know, chronic hepatitis C infection, you know, your liver is essentially taught the T cells to not fight it effectively, right? Interestingly, in the same way, we worry that having liver metastatic disease leads to this ability of T cells to essentially just not either two things, not attack tumor, but not even come around a tumor. And so there's a tumor microenvironment aspect to that as well. So when you think about the microenvironment within the lung versus the liver, those are two very distinct microenvironments where T cells are completely absent. So we think about microsatellite stable colorectal cancer as being an immune desert, particularly in liver metastatic disease. But when you look at the lung, we are starting to see some response rates suggesting that the tumor microenvironment is a little bit different in that area.
But when you say the liver is the school, so you're saying the liver modifies T cells?
So there's some evidence to actually suggest that.
Wow.
And so we see that not only in cancer, but in infectious disease as well. You know, again, a lot of this is just hypothesis, right, generating. But when you look at some of the data that's come out, it is suggestive that that plays a role in T cell, absence in these cancers.
Incidentally, I love that take-home point thing. I'm seeing more and more of that in journals as well as presentations. You start out saying what you're going to say, and really, it's a great way to present. So, John, getting into, again, adjuvant therapy of the MSI, we'll talk about neoadjuvant in a second. First of all, I thought that the ATOMIC trial was the first adjuvant IO study, but actually there was one in endometrial cancer. And it was so small, they didn't expect it, but it was positive, even though it was very, because, you know, such a big effect. So anyhow, I didn't know that, but interesting that it was actually done in endometrial cancer. Again, the issue of chemo in this situation, do we really need the chemo? And a question from the audience, what about cell-free DNA to determine whether to use chemo?
So the ATOMIC trial was the best trial design that we could think of in 2015 when it was designed, right? And Frank Sinekrope, who is the author of the study, is the first to admit that that's not the study he would have done today if he could do it over. But as you know, these trials take years and years to enroll and to accrue, and science kind of passes a trial design by. There's a few things, basic principles of immunotherapy for MSI-high colon cancer that we've learned since Atomic was designed. Number one, MSI high disease is innately chemotherapy resistant disease. We've learned that from Foxtrot, where a neoadjuvant chemotherapy strategy was largely ineffective for those patients. And then, of course, we've got Keynote-177, CheckMate-8HW, where immunotherapy is vastly superior to chemotherapy. The other thing we've learned from other tumor types like melanoma is that immunotherapy appears to be most active when you still have the tumor in place. You get a bump up in response rate. Interestingly, you also see an increase in toxicity when you give immunotherapy with an in situ malignancy. So the problem is these lessons have come up, and Atomic was kind of dealing with these uncertainties. It was considered unethical to give somebody immunotherapy alone back in 2015. That would not be considered unethical now by any stretch. So now we've got a situation where we've got an approval with FOLFOX atezo, and I'll be honest, we struggle with it in my practice because we don't want to give patients with stage 3 MSI high colon cancer FOLFOX. It's toxicity. Sometimes you get a lifetime of neuropathy, and we don't even know that it's necessary at all. So as a group at my institution, we are increasingly seeing these patients with MSI high disease before surgery and making a determination right there whether to give more of a neoadjuvant immunotherapy approach, thereby hopefully generating a complete response to avoid giving FOLFOX entirely on the back end. So this is an area where there's a lot of evolution of practice, and we're way out ahead of NCCN guidelines. I don't know if this is happening at your institution, but you just can't argue with the NICHE 2 data, which shows that that neoadjuvant ipi-nivo had 100% disease-free survival at 3 years with 2 doses of immune therapy.
Just to pick up on something you said that I've never heard before, did you say that the toxicity of IOs is greater if the tumor's in place?
Yes.
And what's the mechanism?
It's not known, but I suspect there's some type of epitope spreading that's going on.
Is it proportional to tumor bulk? You have more tumor bulk, more toxicity?
Oh, that's a level of sophistication of that question I couldn't answer.
So another, you know, age-old question, is there a relationship, Chris, between toxicity from immunotherapy to benefit?
You know, I think anecdotally, right, we believe that the answer is yes. I mean, I've had some patients with just horrific toxicity to immunotherapy that have had incredibly durable responses.
Yes.
And, you know, I do want to tag on to John's, you know, phenomenal points. And really, and that is, you know, this is a discussion that has to happen in a multidisciplinary setting. For many of you, and this happens to me as well, if a patient just comes to you following surgery, at least we have an answer, right, to give those patients, right? Because a lot of times we don't necessarily see the patient, you know, up front prior to surgery. But there are kind of two things to keep in mind. Number one, I do worry about overtreatment. Because if we start giving neoadjuvant immunotherapy to stage 2 disease, well, that patient wouldn't have ever gotten treatment anyway, right? You would have just done surveillance. Can you imagine blowing out somebody's adrenal gland by giving them immunotherapy? But on the flip side, what I said is true. I mean, if you ask me what I would I want 6 months of FOLFOX and a year of atezo, or maybe if I had the opportunity to start with neoadjuvant immunotherapy, I'd probably choose neoadjuvant immunotherapy. But now, you know, what used to be maybe a 15-minute discussion in practice, I think is going to turn into about an hour. So.
With the caveat being that you would give that neoadjuvant immunotherapy to somebody with clinical stage 3 disease, right, where they would be looking at FOLFOX immunotherapy on the back end. But a stage 2 patient has such a great long-term outcome from surgery alone, you would hopefully just spare them entirely all that treatment, right? So it's led to a very nuanced discussion in our multi-D.
Yeah, you're going to push on your radiologist to really look for lymph nodes and look for T4 staging as best as they can, right, with the limits of imaging.
I'm starting to get cerebral swelling here, but why does MSI high disease, why is it chemo resistant? How chemo, is it really not even worth giving chemo in, for example, metastatic disease? And what about, I mentioned before, cell-free DNA to determine whether to give chemo without IO?
So Chris, you made this great point. Yeah. If you look at Keynote-177 and CheckMate-8HW, the control arm in both of those studies was chemotherapy, and they did substantially worse than you would expect in an all-comer colon cancer population. You see a progression-free survival for first-line chemotherapy below 6 months.
I'm just saying, why?
Why? We don't know exactly why, but it has been known now for decades that you can't give somebody with MSI high disease 5-FU alone, right? That's been established now for decades. That if you were to give chemo, it has to be with oxaliplatin. Maybe it's the hypermutated phenotype. Maybe it's just got more ways to evade a cytotoxic chemotherapy.
MRD, though?
Oh, MRD. Great question on that. I personally find MRD to be exceptionally helpful for MSI high disease. Many of my patients who have MSI high disease and it's stage 3 and they come back to me in the clinic and they're reading everything online. The amount of information out there for patients, many patients show up knowing that FOLFOX is not going to help them very much. So they're telling me I will not take that chemotherapy. And I say to them, okay, well, let's do a tumor-informed MRD test. And if it's negative, we'll hold tight. And if it's positive, they have metastatic disease. You just can't see it. We know already from CheckMate 8HW and Keynote 177 that immunotherapy is not only more active than chemotherapy, it also cures a majority of patients. So many of my patients in this shared decision-making are making that call. I'll go for the MRD, and then I'll take the immunotherapy rather than go down a cytotoxic pathway.
I have heard a lot of cases of people who, you know, docs are saying, do I keep the IO going? But I've never heard anybody say the majority are cured. That is
If you look at the CheckMate HW, yeah, about at least two-thirds of patients are cured with Ipi-Nivo.
So, Chris, we're going to see more data looking at Ipi-Nivo at ESMO. I was kind of joking with the audience. I took the three-month board thing last night, and they didn't even have Ipi. You know, they're usually 2 years behind.
Yeah.
They didn't even have Ipi-Nivo on the choices for first-line metastatic. So that's how fast things are moving. But, I mean, you put in your talk there, I mean, are you, in what situations are you using Ipi-Nivo for metastatic disease, and what situations single agent?
I think John's point is just so well taken, and that is if you have the opportunity to legitimately cure somebody with metastatic disease, is that worth the added toxicity? And I think many, again, to John's point about shared decision making is so true, but really I think our patients will take short-term toxicity for the chance to have a much, much better long-term outcome. Because we're not talking, you know, so many times in metastatic setting, we talk about extending progression-free survival or more importantly, overall survival by 3 months, 4 months. And that's what leads to FDA approval. Here, when you look at the tail of the curves and you see that there are patients with these durable, I mean, they're going 5 years without progression. I mean, for lack of a better term, that is cure. And I do think that our patients are really asking for that.
So,
in certain frail patients, you may be able to get away with single agent, and I actually had that come up this week in clinic.
John?
There's a lot of surprising findings from CheckMate 8HW that stunned me. One of the most surprising findings for me is that the incremental increase in toxicity from the dual checkpoint blockade was not that great. I mean, there was a small increase in toxicity. I was expecting more.
Right.
It appears to be generally well tolerated. Now, I am empathetic to providers who are in settings where they don't have a lot of specialized expertise around them to help with the toxicity, but certainly at a high-volume academic center, I've got endocrinologists. All they do is manage immunotherapy toxicity. Dermatologists, that's all they manage. Cardiologists, that's all they manage. When I'm around that expertise, I feel like I, obviously you need to have shared decision making with the patient, but when I've got all of this support around me to manage severe toxicity, it does also kind of push me towards more of a dual checkpoint approach.
So imagine you're a general medical oncologist in the community. It's just one tiny part of what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it seems like ASCO, there was a lot of great stuff. We already talked about ESMO. We submitted an abstract to San Antonio I was talking about earlier on breast cancer about how familiar general medical oncologists are with the 12 phase 3 randomized trials you need to know to make a decision in second-line therapy of ER-positive, HER2-negative disease. And there's like 100 other subsets that these people have to be aware of. It's amazing that you all can keep up to date. All right, let's get into some of these questions. Getting back to the localized MSI high rectal story, Chris, 42-year-old patient, locally advanced MSI rectal cancer, responding very well to neoadjuvant dostarlimab. Can you avoid surgery entirely? Another question, do you need to use dostarlimab as neoadjuvant therapy? What about Pembro?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a lot of experience in this room with total neoadjuvant therapy. We know that there's a 30 to 40% you know, clinical complete response rate, and then we watch these patients with non-operative management. You're going to just see this at a much higher rate, clearly, with immunotherapy and MSI high rectal cancer. And I'll tell you that, of course, I think that these patients can defer surgery. This is, you know, tremendously life-changing if patients are going to be left with an APR, right? One of the things that John has probably also experienced in his clinic are patients that receive neoadjuvant immunotherapy, and then the radiologist and the endoscopist are telling you that there's still tumor there. And this comes up, and then you biopsy it, and it's negative, but the endoscopist tells you that's probably not real. I see a tumor there, and the radiologist says, well, there's diffusion restriction in this area. Then you take those patients to surgery, and they have a pathologic complete response. And I think that this is just an area that's going to need additional study. This is a more and more common scenario where the fibrotic scar is still present, but there's actually no tumor there. And you do wonder if there's a role for tumor-informed ctDNA testing, you know, in that space, even though we know that that's not perfect either. And then to the second question of dostarlimab, I mean, certainly most of the data that I showed you is with the dostarlimab. When you look at NCCN, it actually gives you options, right, to do dostarlimab, pembrolizumab, nivolumab. And I do believe that we've seen great results. MD Anderson has a great cohort looking at pembrolizumab in the neoadjuvant setting with outstanding results. So I do believe that you can use any one of those checkpoint inhibitors.
Although, you know, we see time and again that people kind of stick with whatever's used in the trial. You know, like in lung cancer, everybody gets pembro. But then if you have locally advanced, because the data was better with durva, they get durva, so probably more people end up using dostarlimab. We had a case like what you described, incidentally. A general oncologist presented at a conference, and they actually brought up the possibility of keeping the dostarlimab going longer to see if you could. But maybe you're right. Maybe there wasn't really tumor there. That's another interesting thought. So, neoadjuvant therapy for the MSI-high colon situation. John, can you talk a little bit about how you, I mean, this comes up in gastroesophageal cancer as well. How are you thinking this through, particularly in patients who are resectable?
Well, we have already touched on this a little bit. The truth is there is no standard protocol yet or general accepted consensus. My goal is for somebody with MSI-high colon cancer is to figure out any way possible to spare that patient FOLFOX or CAPOX. So I think that the NICHE 2 regimen, Ipi-Nivo, is a very reasonable approach in many patients. I also think that single agent anti-PD-1 is appropriate in certain patients. I think that's a shared decision making. Clearly, you get an incremental increase in toxicity with a dual checkpoint blockade, potentially, though, a more robust response. So I think either approach is appropriate.
So a couple other sort of pragmatic questions. Again, I get this question a lot. What do you do with the patients doing well at 2 years on an IO? Chris, again, MRD, any role there?
Yeah, I believe so. Of course, this is a completely data-free zone. Many of the trials stopped at 2 years. I would say if you have essentially no evidence disease, I think 2 years is a perfectly good landmark to stop immunotherapy, assuming that you have had the durable and in some cases complete radiographic response. The problem too that I mentioned before with rectal cancer is also a problem in the metastatic setting. I've gotten PET scans on patients that have had all kinds of things light up, and then you stop the immunotherapy and the PET scan resolved, and then you're just kind of left with a patient with a durable response. I think it is reasonable if patients are doing well to stop after 2 years. You can always retreat if needed.
So, John, I finally found a Poli case. It was endometrial cancer. Yeah. Guess what? They responded really well to an IO. Do you ever see that in, what is Poli, and do you ever see that in colon?
Yeah, it's like a polymerase epsilon mutation. So it can't even be germline, but essentially it's a DNA repair defect that leads to a hypermutated phenotype. Now, interestingly, doesn't cause as many frameshift mutations, which are more immunogenic. But the bottom line is, yes, in colon cancer with poly, you'll typically see these insanely high tumor mutational burdens, and they can respond to immunotherapy, and I am thinking about an immunotherapy strategy for them, but I'm also mindful of the tumor mutational burden. The higher it is, the more likely they are to benefit. The lower it is, the more I'm leaning towards a dual checkpoint blockade or even standard cytotoxic chemo. So it's something to be mindful about.
But you've seen it?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, a couple more questions, Chris, and then we're going to move on and let John do his talk. Patient gets MSI high to metastatic disease, gets Pembro first line. What about Ipi-Nivo second line? What about the patient is MSI high and BRAF positive?
Yeah, so everybody has an anecdotal case of a patient with MSI high colorectal cancer that got single agent and then responded to doublet. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I would necessarily routinely recommend. You know, this, despite our concerns about chemotherapy in this population, many of these patients probably will get chemotherapy. But I will tell you that I have tried it. Our group has tried it. It doesn't work for everybody. There are anecdotal cases of responses. We have certainly had some. But there's a reason why this isn't like routinely recommended because, you know, again, it's just a whole bunch of anecdotal experience. In regards to patients that are MSI high and BRAF positive, you'll see this fairly frequently. We would always start with immunotherapy. Interestingly, there's a combination study that's being run of immunotherapy in combination with BRAF inhibition. So we'll see what that looks like. But here, with you know, given the response rates and the durability of the response rates, John's going to talk about breakwater for BRAF, but we would want to start with immunotherapy for the MSI high patients, even if they are BRAF mutated.
All right, John, other biomarker-based strategies. There are a lot of them.
Absolutely. This is a topic near and dear to my heart, so I'll go ahead and move forward here. So when we talk about minimal residual disease, I'm standing next to a guru here in this space. I mean, it's essentially this idea that you can use a blood-based assay to detect presence of tumor where clinical exam or radiology studies might be negative. There are a couple of different MRD techniques out there. One class is the so-called tumor-informed, which involves taking a tumor out, developing a custom signature of mutations that are unique to that patient's tumor, and then using that to check for those variants in blood over time. The other is the so-called plasma-only assay, where you just take the kit out, draw two tubes of blood, and send it off to the company and get a result. Requires no tumor tissue. Plasma-only, we have fewer commercial options there. It requires a bit more bioinformatics techniques. There's less validation of it. However, it does offer the advantage of no tumor tissue required and speed for the first assay. The tumor-informed assays are a bit more rigorously validated. Some believe it's more sensitive than the plasma-only assay, but many of our current validation studies are over in this tumor-informed space. So there are a number of, as I said, validation studies out there. The largest we have comes to us from Japan, the so-called GALAXY study. Here they looked at the real-world test characteristics of the Signatera tumor-informed MRD assay. And the key message here is this test is very strongly prognostic. When they draw a single tube of blood after surgery in patients with stage 2 through 4 colon cancer, all of whom were thought to be cured by surgery, you can see a massive prognosis difference between a single negative versus a single positive, both in terms of disease-free survival and overall survival. And one provocative piece of data that comes out of GALAXY is, this is observational data, but they looked at the performance of chemotherapy in patients who were positive versus negative. And what you'll see here is that adjuvant chemotherapy appeared to benefit those patients who were MRD positive, that's shown here on the left. But in this observational data, those patients who are MRD negative did not appear to receive much benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. That, of course, has inspired several validation studies, which I'll go into here in a moment. Here's the dynamic study. This was conducted in Australia. This took patients with stage 2 colon cancer, all of whom were resected with curative intent, and used a tumor-informed assay on all the patients, and they randomized patients 2-to-1 between ctDNA-guided management and standard management. Standard management was adjuvant treatment decisions essentially at the discretion of the clinician versus the ctDNA-guided approach where the patient only got adjuvant chemotherapy if they were positive. Relapse-free survival was the primary endpoint. And we can see here now 5-year relapse-free survival. There was no difference in relapse-free survival or overall survival for ctDNA-guided management versus standard of care. What's important here is those patients who got ctDNA-guided management were half as likely to get adjuvant chemo. So it suggested that you could potentially spare people some chemotherapy, at least in the stage 2 setting. That, of course, has led to many international studies to validate prospectively these de-escalation and escalation approaches. I'm standing next to the PI for Circulate US, so maybe we'll talk about this during questions. But essentially, this is using taking patients with high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer who post-resection, analyzing the ctDNA with the tumor-informed Signatera test. If there's no ctDNA detected, patients are randomized between standard chemotherapy or surveillance. If there is ctDNA detected, patients are randomized between standard adjuvant chemotherapy or an intensified FOLFIRINOX regimen. Now, some key points. MRD testing is validated as a prognostic tool. There's observational data that suggests there's no advantage for adjuvant chemotherapy if patients have ctDNA negative disease, though there are some very important prospective trials ongoing, including data that will probably be presented at ESMO. For me personally, this is not NCCN. This is my own personal practice. For stage 2 colon cancer, I do consider MRD testing to be a tiebreaker for adjuvant chemotherapy. And I'm very interested to see how these prospective trials will read out. Moving on now to BRAF V600E. This is seen in about 5 to 10% of patients with colon cancer. It's associated with advanced age, more common in women. About a third of these will be MSI high, to that question you just asked. And right now, as of 2020, we have an FDA-approved option, and that's encorafenib and cetuximab, which was shown to be superior to standard of care, at least in the chemotherapy refractory setting. That is the so-called Beacon trial, which inspired the Breakwater study, which the schema is shown here. This looks at patients with metastatic colon cancer, first line, BRAF V600E mutant, randomized to either encorafenib cetux and FOLFOX, or standard of care, which was investigational choice chemotherapy. I'm just out of the interest of time, I'm going to focus on the encorafenib cetux FOLFOX versus standard of care. We can come back to the enco cetux group in questions. That was closed early. Here are the top line results from Breakwater. Encorafenib cetux FOLFOX was superior to standard of care, both for response rate, progression-free survival, and that enco cetux FOLFOX combo doubled survival compared to standard of care. And standard of care was not a weak standard of care. Patients could have received triplet chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, and yet you still see a doubling of survival. This is really an important breakthrough for our patients with this. Take note of that enco cetux column. We can come back to that during questions. It is provocative data, though it was not the primary goal of that study. I will point out that the Breakwater regimen, that enco cetux FOLFOX, does have some increased rate of treatment-related adverse events compared to standard of care or enco cetux alone. Classically, we would see asthenia, rash, pyrexia. Those are some of the more common side effects you would see with that enco cetux FOLFOX combo. But in general, I find it to be pretty well tolerated in the clinic. So some key take-home points. BRAF V600E is associated with poor prognosis. We have a new first-line standard of care of encorafenib, cetux, and FOLFOX for BRAF V600E mutant colon cancer. And I think this really drives home the point that rapid biomarker testing is critical at the time of diagnosis of metastatic disease. Moving on now to KRAS G12C, which is seen in about 3% of patients with metastatic colon cancer. Some important lessons early on. We know that the single agent KRAS G12C inhibitors are active, but the response rate is in the more modest category, lower response rate than you would see with, say, for example, lung cancer, and the duration of responses can be a bit short. So that led to efforts to try to improve that response rate, that PFS with a combo. It appeared that KRAS G12C plus EGFR, just like in BRAF, appears to be more active. that has led to two FDA approvals. The first FDA approval is for adagrasib and cetuximab. This was approved in June of 24 for a response rate of 34%, PFS of over 6 months, and the OS is shown here. Overall, this is a generally well-tolerated regimen. We'll see nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and the rash, and you'll see a dose reduction of adagrasib in about a third of patients due to those treatment-related adverse events. The other regimen we've got now is sotorasib and panitumumab. This is FDA approved based on CodeBreaK 300, which was a randomized study that compared sotorasib at two different dose levels versus investigator choice. And this was FDA approved based on a progression-free survival advantage over investigator choice, as well as you can see the response rate at 26% as well. Overall, I find this to be a very well-tolerated regimen. The most common side effect is skin toxicity. And honestly, in my clinic, I'm oftentimes just giving the panitumumab once a month and keeping the sotorasib going. And patients can stay on this very long. Now, where do we go from here? I think that story we got from BRAF is going to play out just like this in KRAS G12C. We see that the sotorasib panitumumab combination does combine well with drug regimens like FOLFIRI. And look at that response rate for SOTO and PMAB together with FOLFIRI, 47% in fourth line or later. And so it appears that this is a very active combination, and this has led to a first line randomized phase 3 registrational study that's ongoing. So some key points. If you're going to give a KRAS G12C inhibitor in colon cancer, give it with an anti-EGFR. That does improve response rate and PFS. We've got two FDA-approved regimens, and I think that in the future, that breakwater story from BRAF is going to play out as well here in KRAS G12C. I just have a minute for HER2, so I'll go through it quickly. HER2 is seen in about 3% of metastatic colon cancer patients. It's typically seen on the left side and associated with RAS BRAF wild-type disease. So we have two FDA-approved options here as well. This is the Mountaineer regimen. This is kind of a weird schema. It's because I wrote it as an IIT for cohort A, and it works so well in cohort A, we turned the IND over to the company to expand for registration. But this was a study that looked at patients who had progressed on FOLFIRI and FOLFOX, looked at the tucatinib-trastuzumab combination. Primary endpoint was response rate, and now we have long-term results which show a confirmed objective response rate of 39%. Look at the median duration of response, over 15 months with a PFS over 8 months. In a refractory setting, that's impressive. And I've shown a spider plot on the right of these long-term responses. We have several patients who enrolled that had a complete response lasting over 5 years. And for a regimen that's highly selective and targeted, where tolerability is the primary goal, that's just such a win for our patients. In terms of the side effects you can expect, typically it's diarrhea with this, but it's generally grade 1 and 2, and it very rarely leads to dose reduction. So just having the Imodium around seems to get the job done for this. The other option we've got that's FDA approved is trastuzumab deruxtecan. This is DESTINY-CRC01 data, which showed a very impressive response rate of 45%, PFS of 6.9 months. But there was a lot of toxicity with this. There were 3 deaths in DESTINY-CRC01 related to ILD or pneumonitis, thought to be maybe related to that high dose they used here of 6.4 mg per kg. That led to the DESTINY-CRC02 study shown here, which compared 2 different doses of TDXD, the breast dose, 5.4 mg per kg, or what I call the gastric dose of 6.4. Numerically, the response rate was higher with the lower dose, with a similar PFS. So I think this really did say you're not sacrificing anything by going with the lower dose. Importantly, though, the toxicity is probably more favorable with that lower dose of 5.4 mg per kg. No deaths from ILD or pneumonitis at 5.4 mg per kg here. 3 important lessons from DESTINY-CRC02 as I wrap up. Number 1, unlike other diseases, in colon cancer is different. All the responses here, save one, were in patients with IHC3+ disease. This is a drug that's not very active when you get into 2+ FISH positive. Additionally, we see responses in patients with RAS mutations. And the final lesson is the response rate was the same whether or not that patient had been exposed to prior anti-HER2 therapy, which is important as we think about sequencing these therapies. So just leave you with my personal, how I treat HER2-positive metastatic colon cancer. I think the key thing is we've got to test right up front. We've got to find out if they're HER2-positive. I will generally give an induction chemotherapy regimen, chemo-bev. And if there's no RAS or BRAF mutation present, I'm going to tucatinib trastuzumab right out of the gate. And at progression on that, then I'm thinking about T-DXd to salvage that patient. However, if there's a RAS mutation present, they go straight to T-DXd. So with that, I'll wrap up. Thanks.
So my desk is covered with questions from the audience. I don't know if I can get through all these, but just kind of getting back to, before we get into what you were talking about, I was just kind of reflecting back when we were talking about MSI-high localized colorectal cancer, Chris. What are the situations where you need to do MSI testing before you make a plan? It seems like everybody with rectal, but what about colon?
Yeah, I think that as soon, what this data has told us is that as soon as we get the biopsy for the colonoscopy, that testing's got to be done. At most of our practices, is going to be an IHC for a mismatch repair. That will capture a vast majority of them. If you're able to get MSI-high testing done really quickly, that's fantastic, but most of these are going to come as IHC, and they need to be reflexive. So in other words, no physician should be ordering this. The pathology should be doing this automatically.
So just another quick question about the HER2 story there, John. Can you explain a little bit more about why people with RAS mutations don't respond to tucatinib trastuzumab?
So in fairness to tucatinib trastuzumab, we haven't really looked at it before. The reason why I wrote the trial to exclude RAS mutations is we were looking at the MyPathway data, which looked at trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and saw that KRAS mutations did appear to drive resistance to that selective approach. So we just kind of cut them out of the trial. And the theory here is that the RAS mutation, which is downstream of the MAP kinase pathway, will kind of salvage MAP kinase pathway activation, similar to how a KRAS mutation drives resistance to, say, an EGFR antibody. Now, T-DXd is different. That's a cytotoxic. That just needs some type of HER2 expression to get in the cell. So the presence of, it's not downregulating a pathway, it's delivering a cytotoxic, which is why I think that is more active in that space. But it's something worth looking at in the future.
So you also were saying you kind of prefer the tucatinib approach in general because there's no ILD. What about the patient who's symptomatic or needs a response?
Well, certainly up front, before they've had any type of treatment, if they need a response, I will oftentimes start with FOLFOXIRI, bevacizumab, FOLFIRINOX, bev.
Yeah, I'm talking about the recurrent HER2 positive.
If they need a response, there is no data to indicate that, if you look at the response rates side by side, cross-trial comparison, so with all those caveats, the response rate is the same between T-DXd and tucatinib trastuzumab. The one thing I will say about tucatinib trastuzumab, you generally know within about a week whether the patient's responding. Because that mechanism of action, that TKI, is so quick, sometimes patients will be relieved of symptoms within days of starting it. If you're not seeing that relief pretty quickly, that would be an alarm bell for me.
What about CNS mets with HER2-positive colorectal?
Yeah, from my experience as an investigator on Mountaineer, I would say I would estimate maybe 15 to 20% of patients at some point during their disease course will develop brain mets with HER2-positive disease. So I'll tell you, when I have a bunch of HER2-positive patients in my clinic from these trials and others, I am not necessarily getting a brain MRI up front, but I'm listening very carefully for any subtle symptom that might justify an MRI of the brain. And because, it could be just, hey, I'm a little off with my balance, but I would have a very low threshold to get that imaging.
And you see responses with both T-DXd and tucatinib trastuzumab?
Yeah, they're both known to...
Like breast.
Yeah, it's actually pretty rare to have a treatment progression in the CNS on one of those two regimens. They're both active in the CNS.
So let's get back to cell-free DNA and MRD, Chris. So here are a couple of presentations we're going to see at the ESMO meeting, the Dynamic 3 trial, and also the Intercept trial. Anything that you're going to be looking for at ESMO from these or other studies, Chris?
Yeah, I think particularly for Dynamic 3, everybody's going to be very interested in the de-escalation arm for patients that are ctDNA negative. So the one thing to kind of keep in mind, Dynamic 3 presented their ctDNA positive escalation arm, which was negative. So you're going to be looking at the difference in disease-free survival in the de-escalation arm in the ctDNA negative patients. John showed you outstanding observational data from Galaxy. We really need that randomized control data because, you know, I think escalating, right, to me as a practitioner, doing like using it in stage two, and if a patient is ctDNA positive, escalating to giving chemotherapy, that's kind of like common sense, just as John had mentioned. It's something that isn't necessarily in the NCCN guidelines, but gosh, if your patient is ctDNA positive, they're probably going to want something as opposed to nothing. But then to make a de-escalation decision based off of ctDNA, we have to be extraordinarily careful with that because we don't want to harm patients by not giving them chemotherapy. That's where Dynamic 3 will hopefully help us, and it will also help us, obviously, to have to circulate North America data as well.
Also important, if the patient wants to be involved in the decision, to give them that option when there's no clear-cut pathway. So, John, you were talking about the difference between tumor-naive and tumor-informed assay. It sounds like the tumor-informed really is where we're heading. What are there other, is that true? And also, is there a role for tumor-naive assays? And are there other tumor-informed assays like Signatera that are in development and looking promising?
Yeah, I think actually the right answer is we're going to need both. The one major limitation of a tumor-informed assay is that first test can take a long time to come back. If you're trying to make an adjuvant decision and you're seeing that maybe that patient maybe 3 or 4 weeks post-op and the tumor tissue somewhere else and it takes 6 weeks to build the assay, you're talking about using that data for a decision at week 12 post-op. We know that's not a good thing to wait a long time to start adjuvant. So there is a role for this blood-only test to kind of accelerate your decision-making. The one thing I will say is that there are a lot of different tests and technologies out there. We have no head-to-head comparisons. If the decision is to de-escalate treatment, for me as a clinician, I want a very sensitive assay. I want the most exquisitely sensitive assay because if I'm going to withhold chemotherapy and say someone with stage 3 disease, I want the most sensitive assay there is, and they're not all the same. If the decision is to escalate treatment to something more intense, I want the most specific assay, right? I don't want any false positives so that I give a very potent, you know, regimen to somebody. And the problem is with all these assays, there's always a trade-off between sensitivity and specificity.
What about Signatera versus other assays? You know, I had the privilege of interviewing Soon Paik in 2004, the night before he presented the Oncotype for the first time, and then we just saw that evolve. And there, you know, there are other assays out there, but they had so much data. There wasn't, you know, you didn't have any, the amount of data. Are there other assays that are being studied, or is it more like Signatera?
Yeah, so yeah. There are a lot of companies. This is just an incredibly burgeoning field, and so you'll see many, many companies with exome assays and now genome assays. But to your point, with Signatera and that specific test, that is the test that's being used in a lot of clinical trials as well. Mm-hmm.
So here's a good one, John. Outside of a clinical trial, how are you utilizing ctDNA in stage 2 and stage 3 disease? And how does that line up with the guidelines that are out there?
Well, the guidelines are rather conservative. So I think actually the rest of the world is behaving differently than the guidelines. So how am I using it? Number one, before getting this test, I think it's absolutely critical to sit down with the patient and explain the test to them and decide whether it's right for them. Because it's not part of our guidelines. Some patients feel very empowered by that information and use that information to help them plan their lives. Some patients, frankly, it consumes them, right? And, you know, I think the first question you have to ask yourself is, how are we going to respond to a positive and how are we going to respond to a negative? Because I assure you, the first time there's a positive result, that patient's going to call your clinic. What's the plan, right? and God forbid you're out of town, right? So it's important to say, this is what we're going to do if it's positive. This is what we're going to do if it's negative. So that patient doesn't feel completely confused and lost. I do like this test a lot for stage 2 disease because we're very much on the fence of whether to give chemotherapy at all. So I do find it useful for de-escalating treatment sometimes where you're on the fence about chemo and then also potentially being more intense if it's positive. For stage 3, I think it's a bit more uncertain, and that's more of a case-by-case decision. Look, there are some patients who do not do well with CAPOX, get a lot of toxicity. I would like to know if they're ctDNA negative, because if they're really struggling with CAPOX, that might give me more confidence to do, say, 3 months of FOLFOX, right? So, you know, there are ways we can use it, even in stage 3 disease, but certainly it needs to be that discussion with the patient.
No, I love that idea of, you know, telling the patient. I mean, same thing with Oncotype. You know, if they're not going to take chemo no matter what, don't order the Oncotype.
Right, exactly. But
also, in terms of one situation I hear a lot from docs in practice, Chris, is a patient with stage 3 but only a couple nodes. They're 80 years old or 75 years old. They're really anti-chemo. How bad in that situation?
Yeah, actually, this is the exact conversation I've had in clinic with some of my patients that either are wholeheartedly against chemotherapy,
right,
but might change their mind if they're ctDNA positive or if they're elderly or frail or have a lot of comorbidities. And that's where we basically can, to John's point of having that discussion, if it's positive, will you take chemotherapy, even if it's like single agent, right, 5-FU or capecitabine? And if the answer is yes, if I got this test and it was positive, then it would move into chemotherapy, but otherwise I'm going to refuse chemotherapy. You just document that, you get the test, and then you have that conversation with the patient. I think it's a phenomenal way to use the test in actual practice.
So I did a recording session with John recently, and we went through this data with celecoxib, and also I think there's a study there with aspirin, which is super mind-blowing. So am I right in saying the people who were MRD positive benefited?
Do we have another hour for this? We can talk about this.
I want you to explain the other thing he told me that I never heard before, and I've been telling the other, you know, breast people, et cetera. You said that the way aspirin and celecoxib work is through the AKT pathway?
Well, PI3 kinase pathway, yeah. Right? So, So let's start with the CALGB 80702 first. This was a retrospective analysis. This was a 2x2 design where they were comparing 3 versus 6 months of chemotherapy and celecoxib or placebo. And what they found in this retrospective analysis is that even though celecoxib offered no benefit in the overall population, there was clearly a disease-free survival benefit among those patients who were ctDNA positive. What was odd about this was the benefit was there whether or not the patient had a PI3 kinase mutation, which we think is, or a PIK3CA mutation, which we think is the biomarker that would predict sensitivity. Now, celecoxib is a COX-2 inhibitor, thought to modulate that PI3 kinase pathway. The other thing you mentioned is aspirin. I will point out there is a New England Journal paper within the last few weeks from the Alaska investigators that did show a recurrence-free survival benefit for adjuvant aspirin among those patients with a PI3 kinase alteration, and that is now in our national guidelines. So test your patient for one of these PIK3CA mutations after resection of a colon or rectal cancer, and if they have it, please give aspirin.
But they don't respond to PIK3 inhibitors.
Well, we don't do that in colons.
So they're going to do it in prostates soon, maybe. I don't know. All right, so one final question, Chris. ctDNA and oligometastatic disease, or liver only mets.
There's always been this really interesting data about perioperative chemotherapy having a disease-free survival benefit, but none of the individual trials showing an overall survival benefit. Again, I think that this is a conversation that you're going to have with your patients. It's really unclear what adjuvant chemotherapy does after liver resection. And so if your patients are going to tell you that ctDNA may change their management either to refuse chemotherapy or to accept additional chemotherapy, I think it's reasonable to use.
I use it
Yep.
in this setting.
All right. Thank you so much.